Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
It's back. A bit of a celebratory atmosphere again for Kavanaugh. Haven't really been able to play that since the Blasé Ford allegations, but Kavanaugh obviously confirmed over the weekend as expected. And so interesting reactions coming in from all quarters, as you would suspect. How about we start with the top guy? That would be the President of the United States. That would be Donald Trump, who was on, graciously called into his friend Jeanine Pirro's show on Saturday night.
I wonder how she got that phone call.
And offer his review.
Well, for one thing, it would have been very unfair to him, if you think about it. He's a highly respected man. What the Democrats did was disgraceful. These things happened that just came out of the wind. There was no corroboration. There was no anything, Jeanine. This is a high-quality, brilliant man. He'll be a phenomenal Supreme Court justice. And it was my honor to stick. And I know that. A lot of people told me that. They said, well, we'll switch. You'll never get anybody like this. This is a very, very outstanding person and individual with an incredible family. And it would have been very unfair to him. What they did was disgraceful. What the Democrats did.
And so sort of restating the position that the president has offered throughout this process in defense of his nominee. In addition to that, Trump addressed the issue that where he received some criticism down the stretch, and that was the treatment of Blasé Ford at that infamous Mississippi rally.
It was a very unfair situation. So I evened the playing field. And once I did that, it started to sail through. He was treated very, very unfairly, Jeanine.
Oh, so he's claiming that because he made that comment at that rally, that that's why things changed for Kavanaugh?
Well, certainly he was flying in formation with what his friend Jeanine Pirro was saying. on Murkowski.
Your dogs are barking. Your feet smell so bad that they are barking.
Is it time for animal stories? Trump on Murkowski.
I don't know what's going to happen to her. I thought it was a very, very sad vote. I thought it was very, frankly, disgraceful. And I appreciate that a Democrat, Joe Manchin, came and he voted in favor of Justice Kavanaugh, and that was a good thing. But that was very disappointing. The people of Alaska, I've had tremendous success in Alaska, and what I've done for them with ANWR, which is one of the biggest drilling sites in the world. Ronald Reagan tried to get it approved. Bush tried to get it approved. Everybody tried to get it approved for close to 50 years. I got it approved. It means trillions of dollars, and I'm not equating one thing with the other at all, but I've done so much for Alaska. I was shocked to see her vote, absolutely shocked, and frankly, so were other Republicans. It was a very sad day, I think, for her.
And did you see Sarah Palin's tweet in response to Murkowski?
No, what did she do?
Sarah Palin tweeted, Lisa Murkowski, I can see 2022 from my porch.
That's actually pretty
clever. It's pretty funny.
For
Palin. Pretty clever. So
she voted president so that Mr. Daines could go to his daughter's wedding and walk her down the aisle, which you didn't think was a big, important deal.
It wasn't an important deal.
Because you said, well, he'll be there for the second wedding.
No, that wasn't me, actually. That was, don't put Sean from Elmwood Park's tweets on me.
They're still married, by the way, just so you know.
So, right. That was her compromise position for her colleague. So there's one version or there's one comment on Murkowski, who was the one Republican who left the fold. And then there's the heroine of the moment after announcing finally her what her vote would be on Saturday afternoon.
It was so traumatic, wasn't it?
Indeed. Or Friday afternoon, excuse me. The days run together. Here's Trump on Susan Collins, the senator from Maine.
But I will tell you, Susan Collins was a star. What she did was incredible. I spoke to her yesterday. What she said and the way she said it was brilliant, and it really covered it.
So your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Let's take your reaction to Kavanaugh's confirmation before we get into some of the implications of it for November 6th and beyond. It is interesting to note that one of the female accusers is not going to pursue her allegations, and the other seems intent on doing so.
Yeah, Blase Ford, her attorney, spoke with Dana Bash about, you know, what's next? Are you going to continue to, you know, go for impeachment hearings?
Would Professor Ford like impeachment proceedings to begin?
Professor Ford has not asked for anything of the sort. What she did was to come forward and testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee and agree to cooperate with any investigation by the FBI. And that's what she sought to do here.
So no, she's not going there on impeachment?
No.
She does not want him to be impeached?
No.
Well,
and the way she says, like, no. Why would we? This is her bread and butter now. It would not help their client financially if Kavanaugh was taken off the Supreme Court, because she's making money. Dan, she's going to go big. Oh, she is with her GoFundMe, and she wouldn't be as popular, I don't think, if he wasn't on the court.
Well, there's two things. One is she going to file a police report? Remember, there's no statute in Montgomery County, as has been mentioned numerous times throughout this process. So if the claim was serious enough that he should not be elevated to the high court, then one, why don't you pursue it as a criminal matter?
Right.
And two, if it was serious enough to keep him off the court and you have more than a dozen Democrats saying they'll pursue impeachment, impeachment Brett Kavanaugh, impeachbrett.org. There's a petition that's already circulating. Newsweek reported on it over the weekend. So Democrats are going to continue to stay stuck on stupid, and I mean that politically, and I'll explain a little bit later. But there, Cory Booker was in Iowa. He said impeachment isn't off the table. So I guess my questions would be, I mean, not if Ford wants to recoil from the public arena, fine, that's her choice. But it'd be interesting to get an explanation as to why you're not pursuing criminal charges and why you wouldn't pursue or support the pursuit of impeachment when you have leading Democrats already suggesting they will. There's
the reason why also, too, they're hands off is because I don't think she was really a victim of his.
Well,
I mean, I've said that all along. Something did happen to her, but it wasn't him who did it.
Well, that's what Susan Collins said over the weekend as well, in explaining her vote on State of the Nation.
I found Dr. Ford's testimony to be heart-wrenching, painful, compelling, and I believe that she believes what she testified to. I don't think she was coming forth with a political motive, although I do not think that she was treated well by those who breached her confidence. But we also had a case where Judge Kavanaugh came forward and said, I'm 100% certain that this did not happen. So here you have two people who are each 100% certain of what they're saying under pain of perjury. So then I had to look at the other evidence and was there corroborating evidence. And that's why I pushed hard for the FBI to do a supplemental background investigation.
So do you still think it is possible that he did it? You just don't have the proof to back that up?
I do not believe that Brett Kavanaugh was her assailant.
Yeah, so there you go. No uncertain terms. Interesting. So Ms. Ford recoiling from the public arena, but not Avenatti and Julie Swetnick.
Well, some Democrats were blaming Avenatti and Julie Swetnick.
No question.
Because of their shenanigans.
No question. I certainly hope that doesn't derail his 2020 bid.
Oh, yeah. Me neither.
She said in a statement released by Avenatti, Julie Swetnick, "I'm disgusted and appalled by the way I have been re-victimized over the last 2 weeks after I had the courage to come forward." Uh-huh.
She victimized herself by telling the truth to Kate Snow. She's trying to snowball us, huh?
It could have been Brett Kavanaugh, but I can't
confirm it. But I don't know.
Yeah.
Remember, she said that.
Frank in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I was just thinking that Kavanaugh is a real big believer in precedent. Now, Clarence Thomas used the technique of deny, deny, deny. So he figured, hey, that's precedent. I'll deny, 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 and maybe it'll work out for me too.
Yeah, okay. There's also the possibility, Frank, you could contemplate that he denied, 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 not as a strategy, but as a reflection of the truth.
Because one of them is not telling the truth, and I'm believing Kavanaugh.
Or they're you know, I mean, you get into the psychology of all this and all this this discussion. You repeat something enough, or you have a traumatic moment and you misidentify the accuser. I mean, but you honestly, you're not being duplicitous. You honestly are mistaken. So honest mistake or whatever. There's always that possibility. There was a tweet over the weekend I thought was a good insight. It was interesting, this tweeter observes. Brett Kavanaugh, surrounded by family, friends, colleagues, all coming forward to vouch for him, to rally to his defense. Ms. Ford, Hollywood celebrities, Democrat politicos, no family,
yeah,
no
where's
friends.
Her husband and...
No family, no friends to corroborate her story, even to rally her to her defense in any public way. Kavanaugh, family, friends, colleagues over decades. It's an interesting contrast.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Some other reactions. I mean, you know, women, ladies, you really want to cast your lot with Linda Sarsour and the P-Hat Posse? Did you see what the statement they released about Susan Collins? Susan Collins is the mother and grandmother of white women in America who gave us a Trump presidency, the 53%. She's a disgrace, and her legacy will be that she was a traitor to women in marginalized communities. Behold the quiet grace and dignity and tolerance of the left. It's really quite something, isn't it? By the way, the call that Trump made on Saturday night
to
Jeanine Pirro, Judge Pirro. Not the only call he made, apparently. UFC 42,015 also happened this weekend on Saturday night.
Oh, yeah. Did you see that? The one in, you're talking about the one in Vegas?
Yeah.
Where the fight started after the fight?
Yeah.
Or during the fight?
A bit of a melee after the Conor McGregor fight after he was defeated. But Derek Lewis wins a comeback knockout in his fight. And then you had the post-fight interview with Joe Rogan, which started off colorfully and then became quite revealing.
I'm here with the winner, Derek Lewis. Derek, why'd you take your pants off?
My balls was hot.
It's a good reason. It's a good reason to take your pants off.
Did he say my...
He said my balls were hot.
Were hot?
Yeah, that's why he took his pants off.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. All right, Derek, please put your pants back on now.
We have to continue the interview.
And then what inspired Derek Lewis to his comeback victory?
And you were looking for that big haymaker all night. You found it in the last minute of the fight.
I forgot. A few hours before the fight, Donald Trump called me and told me I got knocked this Russian out because they're making him look bad on the news. You know, him and Putin. They're talking about USA and his whole.
Yeah, so.
Wait, did that really happen?
That really happened. So,
well,
I mean.
With the pants, I mean. No, I'm kidding.
Trump,
with the
phone
call.
Trump continues, I don't know if it happened or not, but Trump continues to KO the opposition. You got UFC fighters, you got your Brett Kavanaugh. You tired of winning yet? Are you sick of winning?
Like our Blaine volleyball team. Are you tired of winning?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. See Heather McDonald, James O'Keefe, and Sheriff David Clark at Freedom Summit 2018. Get your tickets at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Get your reactions to the Van Dyke verdict on Friday. Friday, busy day. Saturday, busier day. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line.
I don't know if Saturday was a busy day because everything was canceled. Homecoming football games, homecoming dances, pep rallies. And this is, I mean, I texted you right away because Peyton was all dressed up and nowhere to go Friday night. They canceled.
No football games.
No football games, no homecoming dances. Even, but they knew what the verdict was. I mean, after they found out what the verdict was, I'm surprised that they canceled everything.
Well, you still wanted to see what the reaction was, and thankfully the reaction was peaceful and largely celebratory, although not in all quarters. But it certainly was peaceful, and that was good. Jace Van Dyke being convicted of second-degree murder and all 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm.
Do you want to hear it?
His bail revoked, and he'll be sentenced in about a month or so, but obviously he's looking at perhaps as much as the rest of his natural life in prison, but certainly a long jail sentence.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of second-degree murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of aggravated battery with a firearm, first shot. We, the jury, find the defendant...
And went on 16 times, but then this happened.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, not guilty of official misconduct.
So that means that he acted in accordance with what he learned as a police officer.
Yeah, I mean,
that was straight. Like, he was found guilty on all those other charges, and then on that, not found guilty of police misconduct.
Well, here's the thing. The interesting thing about that, 16 guilty verdicts on aggravated assault with a firearm. So as much has been made of the 16 shots, what the jury decided, and this seems to have been somewhat lost in the analysis, this is important. What the jury decided is that he should have never discharged his weapon. That one time was improper. That one time, if he would have killed Laquan McDonald with his first shot, he still would have been guilty of second-degree murder. So the 16 shots essentially just are piling on the one wrong judgment call according to the jury's verdict, and that shouldn't be lost. That's what they're saying. And this is what we'll talk with Van Dyke's defense attorney, Dan Herbert, about at 7:35, and then the special prosecutor in the case, Joe McMahon, at 8:08. By the way, just on McMahon.
Yeah.
For all of those Chicago and celebrating, I haven't heard a lot of job well done. Thank you to the key Republican in the case.
Do they know he's Republican?
Joe McMahon, the special prosecutor in the case, is the Kane County State's Attorney. He's a Republican. I know Republican, Democrat doesn't matter, shouldn't matter. Well, I should say doesn't matter. I know Republican, Democrat shouldn't matter when it comes to carrying out your professional duties. I know it shouldn't matter when it comes to carrying out your duties in public office, but it does. That's what the electorate has said in this county and city and state.
Well, I did listen to Laquan McDonald's great uncle. He had a press conference, and he did thank Joe McMahon. But he also said this, and if any of you black people know what it's like to get pulled over in King County, well, you know, we weren't too sure about King County. That's what he said. Because I was listening in my car to his entire press conference and went, wow.
Well, it's interesting. You know what?
Okay.
You know what? At least that's honest.
Yeah.
At least it's honest to say, you know what? We have a bias against white suburbanites, white suburbanite Republicans. That's what he's essentially saying. But hey, this white Republican suburbanite who's a Kane County prosecutor surprised us and he did his job. So maybe one of the positive things that can come out of the Van Dyke trial is a little bit less of belief in the leftist demagoguery about all white people are this or all Republicans are that and all black people are this and all Democrats are that. Do you find it tiresome? You should.
Well, three of the jurors sat down with reporters, didn't give their names. And their one common theme I kept hearing from the jurors, and then later other jurors came that just audio only interviews, that he should not have testified in his own defense.
Right. Same. I didn't think he should have testified because he kept going from one question and he would answer this question. Then he would go back and then he act like he didn't remember. He only remembered what he wanted to.
It felt like it was a rehearsed situation, and I didn't quite trust that.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Another key takeaway, as powerful as the video is, and that certainly was a central piece of evidence. But it's important to note as well that the jury did not find Van Dyke credible as a witness.
No.
So, you know, he shouldn't have testified. I mean, it's a bit of a catch-22. If he doesn't testify, then the video is the thing that's indelible, right? And if he does testify and he's not credible, then it just sort of confirms your impression about the video. And that's essentially what the jury said.
It seemed very rehearsed. It seemed kind of like he was finally giving the play after what they've been rehearsing with him for weeks. And personally, even though we're right here, I felt him staring at us, tried to win our sympathy in a way, I guess. And I think we all kind of felt the same way, even with that, like when we're still sitting here, we felt the same way by all looking at each other and writing stuff down at the same time, that we just didn't buy it.
Here's what Joe McMahon had to say, the special prosecutor in the case from Kane County.
Today, our justice system fulfilled its obligation of justice for all.
Take your calls, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
One person the defense brought forward that they weren't too pleased with was their medical examiner, who did an independent investigation, and they, you know, said that she was standoffish. They did not like her at all.
Phillip. The medical examiner. Her.
And why?
Because she broke down every bullet, what it did, how it went in, which way it went in, how it came out. Or did it come out?
There was another pathologist the defense put on the stand. What did you make of her?
Really didn't care for her. I thought she was kind of cocky. She didn't listen. She wanted to overtalk people.
Phillip in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
I'm kind of sitting there thinking how sad it is. Actually, he probably, Van Dyke probably shouldn't have just been on the force that night. Nobody else shot. And I think that had he not even been out there that night, none of this would have happened. But it's kind of indicative, listening to some of his testimony, how he probably should have not even been on the police force, because he just seems like, he just didn't seem like the right material for mentally and physically and other things to be in such a stressful position. But I'm just going to break it down that I don't think he should have been on the force. He shouldn't have been on the street that night. Just nobody else shot.
Yeah.
And it's just sad that Laquan McDonald had to. And again, you know, I think I heard your co-host say that, you know, I think 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, that the taser group showed up or whatever. Mm-hmm. But with all those cops out there, it seemed like they just could have, you know, tackled him. He just had a 3-inch knife. So it just seems, the whole thing seems ridiculous. And I think Van Dyke was mostly, he convicted himself on his actions and his words and his deeds that night. So
right.
I'm just glad it's over with, and hopefully we could find some common ground.
All right.
Finally, hopefully.
Thanks for the call, Phillip.
The juror said that they never considered, they were just deciding between first and second degree murder.
Yeah, they moved past the possibility of acquittal relatively quickly. Yep. Verlon on the south side.
Yeah, I always said that he would never get convicted of first degree murder. But I'm going to put a bow on what you were saying as far as the shots and all that type of stuff. They convicted him of second degree murder just so they can get him on something. Now, as far as each shot they convicted him on, the reason why they convicted him on 6-30, which was aggravated battery on each shot, was because each shot was intent, and they could get him like that as intent for each shot. Now, wow. I was kind of happy over the weekend when the verdict came in, but then I had to think about it. It's only symbolism. Honestly, it's only a bunch of symbolism, because when you sit back and really put your mind to it, one young man lost his life. Another man is about to lose his life to time. And then next year at this same time, it won't even be thought of. It'll be a footnote in history. So what did it really do for us? Nothing. It was just a tragic storm that happened that night. I'm not going to repeat what Phil said as far as him not being fit to be on the force. It was just a bad night, and his judgment wasn't there. But as far as him being a good cop, I mean, I haven't heard anything bad about him being a good cop. But the moral to the story is two people just lost their lives on a bad night.
It was storming out, too, and lightning, and I thought, God, his first night in jail has got to be just horrifying.
Well, here's
to know that you're not going to get out. I mean, what's he looking at, 96 years? If you add up every first-degree murder charge is 3 to 6 years, and then the, you know, second-degree murder charge.
Every aggravated assault with a firearm is 6 to 30.
Oh.
And then you've got, second-degree murder, technically, I believe, is probationable, but that's not going to happen.
No.
With the symbolism of it, though, that Verlon was talking about, this is part of why it's so important that his conviction to the black community in Chicago. This is Gator Bradley, you know, the gangbanger turned community activist.
In 50 years, there hasn't been a police officer convicted for murdering a citizen in Chicago.
And so, you know, there obviously have been cases where there has been police abuse. And police have gotten away with abusing black people and others, but black people here specifically, over the generations. And so Van Dyke's conviction was sort of a proxy for justice for those who were victimized by, say, example, John Burge and his crew and others. And so I understand that pent-up frustration. I understand looking for a different outcome as a symbol that things have changed. It's dangerous because you have to look at these cases individually, right? The facts in every case is different, and you don't prosecute somebody in the present for the crimes of somebody else in the past. That's where we have gone so wrong in our politics. But I understand the celebratory nature of the reaction. It was also interesting to hear from Will Calloway, who is one of the two activists responsible for the video becoming public.
Yep.
Remember these two sort of independent journalists that pushed through FOIA to get the video released because you knew Tiny Dancer and his crew wasn't going to release it. And certainly they were successful pushing it off past the 2015 election. Also an underreported part of the story over the weekend.
I know the whole country is looking at Chicago right now, and I just want the country to know it was only because of God that we got justice.
Well, God and
persistence.
Yeah, you know, pray like it depends on God, act like it depends on you. And Calloway and his cohort did when it comes to pursuing the release of that video.
It was just a sad day on Friday all around.
Well, and here's the other thing.
And scary.
Yeah, here's the other thing, just in terms of scale. You know, if this is about trying to preserve innocent life in the city, it's trying to stop the systemic violence in certain neighborhoods. HeyJackass.com, HeyJackass, you know, the crime stat site that we routinely cite. He tweeted, in the time between the shooting of McDonald on October 20th of 2014 and the verdict on October 5th of 2018, so 4 years, Chicago tallied 2,493 homicides with an additional 11,334 people shot and wounded. And let me tell you, as you, of course, know, it is an infinitesimal percentage, thousandths of a percentage point with respect to police shootings included in those numbers. So you can say that there was sort of a long-awaited justice for a cop who behaved badly, made a bad judgment call, took a life with the Van Dyke conviction. But I wish there would be the same energy towards looking internally at what's happening in the city, civilian to civilian. I understand police are held to a higher standard. I say it all the time. I get the difference between police and civilians. But the violence ultimately is the issue, isn't it? Safety ultimately is the issue, isn't it? And so 2,493 murders, 11,334 shot and wounded since McDonald's shooting 4 years ago. It's staggering. Pam in Brookfield.
Good morning, guys. Anyway, a lot of thoughts on a lot of things. But anyway, I was downtown on, first of all, I watched the whole thing with the testimony, and I consider her to be the Manchurian candidate. I believe she's been brainwashed. I'm not going to go into that.
Are you talking
and
about,
I'll go
are,
into
are you
that
talking about
later,
Kavanaugh?
But as far as this policeman, you know, there's, what, 11 different definitions of kill. Murder one, and that's what they wanted, was murder one. And that would be going with malice to kill somebody.
Right.
Yeah.
Just intently. He was going, knowing this guy's on PCP, and I know they reported he said to his partner, we may have to shoot him.
Right.
Now, the other thing is this. You got somebody, I have seen this. I've lived in Chicago all my life. And people that are that doped up can lift up a car. Mm-hmm. And we could say, well, he shot him 16 times. Well, you know what? They just don't go down. And the thing is, there could have been, he was serving and protecting and doing his job. And I think it's another travesty, but I also believe there will be a vindication, so to speak. You know, as with Kavanaugh, isn't this funny? These come up together. And there's, you say all these murders have happened, but who are they targeting? Those that are doing their job. Why did he keep shooting? You've seen Halloween. We've seen the movie. They won't go down. He had to get him down.
Thanks for the call, Pam. I don't know what Mike Myers has to do with this, but okay.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So the question after Kavanaugh's confirmation this weekend, did the Democrats' conduct turn their blue wave into a red riptide? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The landscape is changing quickly, and you see it in the survey results. You see that in the polling, these races. I'm seeing it, you know, in my private life. I'm involved in state legislative races,
yeah.
Illinois political races. I'm seeing it redound to the local level for state and statewide races. There has been a significant move in the direction of Republicans, in part because the enthusiasm gap has narrowed dramatically. And it's narrowed dramatically, I think, in part because of what Mitch McConnell said over the weekend after Kavanaugh's confirmation.
We stood up for the presumption of innocence. We refused to be intimidated by the mob of people that were coming after Republican members at their homes, in the halls. This was about treating someone fairly. This was about evidence being relevant, not about unsubstantiated charges. The tactics that have been employed both by Judiciary Committee, Democratic senators, and by the virtual mob that's assaulted all of us in the course of this process has turned our base on fire.
I think it has turned the base on fire, and it's turned a lot of people who are reasonable and have some sense of fair play in the middle, has turned them off of Democrats. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Are you more motivated to vote now after the last 2 weeks of, Kavanaugh cavalcade?
I'm all in. I think that this might help. Obviously, somebody like Congressman Peter Roskam from some Republicans are thinking, you know what, I'll sit out the midterms, or meh, I'm busy. They're not busy anymore. They're going to be busy voting. on Election Day? Or is what, we're 20, 30 days away?
Even if they say, like, I don't particularly care for Trump's communication style, they're saying, well, wait a second. What I just saw is an effort to railroad somebody. It was character assassination. He wasn't treated fairly. Republicans did treat Blasey Ford respectfully, even if they disagree with her, even if they had legitimate questions about corroboration and her memory of specific details. But there is this, I think, innate sense of what is fair, what is just. The presumption of innocence is an important bedrock principle of a free society. And Democrats threw all that out the window to try and assassinate this guy's character because they disagree with him. And I'm not on board for that. And I'm also not on board for the, you know, public hysterics, like, continued.
Oh,
this is, you know, outside of the Supreme Court building during the confirmation process and vote.
Shut it down! Shut it down!
Banging on the doors.
Shut it down!
Shut it down! Shut it down!
Don't protest on the Supreme Court steps. That is sacred land. You don't.
How you protest. I mean, not pounding on the doors. You can protest outside the Supreme Court. That happens all the time.
Right, but not on the steps and not by the front door.
Yeah, not
reaches the front door.
Behaving like that, or how about this? Actually, in the Senate gallery during the confirmation proceeding, senators were offering their remarks. Mike Pence presiding.
Sergeant at arms will restore order in the gallery.
She looks like a lovely lady. Yeah. Maybe she's single, Dad.
She has something important to say. Please, people, quiet, please.
What? Huh?
Yeah.
The sergeant at arms will restore order in the gallery.
Yeah, the gavel. Wore out that gavel. It was a nub by the end of the confirmation vote.
I think they're handling this well.
The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery.
Mr. Manchin.
Shame! Shame!
The shame mob.
Will suspend. The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery. The sergeant-at-arms will restore order in the gallery. Sergeant-at-arms will restore
Sergeant
order
arms.
In the gallery.
Sergeant-at-arms.
Will you
get there already?
He only has two hands. Here's the thing. So people seeing examples of this throughout the last couple of weeks, and they're asking themselves, do I want to identify on that side of the line?
Well, they're extreme and they're dangerous, and they'll stop at nothing to get what they wanted, but they didn't get what they wanted this time. And President Trump mentioned that over the weekend.
The Democrats have become too extreme and too dangerous to govern.
That's right.
Republicans believe in the rule of law, not the rule of the mob.
There you go.
And there is something to that.
It's a nice contrast that he presents, the rule of law versus the rule of mob. Let me tell you something. The overwhelming majority of Americans are going to side with the rule of law. Now, what that looks like in actual sum and substance is different than on, you know, from a dais just kind of making that overture. But I think that's where the attrition has happened for Democrats, to the benefit of Republicans, is people watching this, listening to this, and they're not liking what they're hearing and seeing from Democrats. And this is why races have moved substantially up and down the ballot, again, even at the local level in a state like Illinois.
Wow. And one thing I wish those protesters knew, so they're still on the steps of the Supreme Court. Kavanaugh comes in, you know, one of those black Cadillacs. And guess who also was there? Elena Kagan and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were there to support Judge Kavanaugh. They were there for his swearing in.
Well, Elena Kagan hired him at Harvard.
Well, I know, but I'm just saying, I wish they would have rolled down the window like, hey, guys, we're supporting him, you know.
Well, the interesting thing is that
RBG.
That there's a the Democrat Socialist base of the Democrat Party has learned no lesson. They are doubling down on what they've done the last 2 weeks, pushing for impeachment. So now Republicans can legitimately say, look, you have Democrats. What their entire value proposition for November 6th is to impeach Trump and impeach Kavanaugh. Is that what you want to do? Is that where you want to go? Even his accuser doesn't want to go there.
No.
That should tell you something, Democrats. But it doesn't, and great. Fine. You're being very helpful. Continue as you were, Democrat Socialists. Greg in Schaumburg.
The answer is yes. There has been a change in particularly all women of reason as a result of the Kavanaugh. And Dan, now this is going to be a Cubs thing, okay, so go with me on it. You need only look across the desk. If you remember when Sean Dunstan played and there was the Shauna meter in center field.
Yes, yeah, sure.
Amy is kind of the Amy meter for American women. If Amy is saying there has been a change, there's been a change.
Okay. All right. Thanks for
Thank
the
you
call,
so
Greg.
Much, Greg.
The Amy-o-meter.
Call in anytime. We're here for you.
Well, on the flip side of this, so we'll have to see how this registers on the Amy-o-meter.
Yes.
Because this is what Democrats are continue to say and do. Alexis Grinnell, op-ed in the New York Times. White women, come get your people. Where are the white women at? They're coming to get their people. These women are gender traitors. Of course, the people supporting Kavanaugh. To borrow a term from the dystopian TV series The Handmaid's Tale. Yawn.
I hate that.
They've made standing by the patriarchy a full-time job, Amy. The
yes.
women who support them show up at the Capitol wearing Women for Kavanaugh t-shirts, but also probably tell their daughters to put on less revealing clothing when they go out. These are the kind of women who think being falsely accused of rape is almost as bad as being raped.
Yeah.
The kind of women who agree with President Trump that it's a very scary time for young men in America. But the people who scare me the most are the mothers, sisters, and wives of those young men, because my stupid uterus still holds out for some insane hope of solidarity. Amy, please address Alexis Grinnell's stupid uterus.
I think I'll let you take that one.
Holly, perhaps you would like to respond
Holly
to Alexis Grinnell's stupid uterus, quote unquote.
I am a proud gender traitor, and as we speak, I am waiting for my Beach Week 82 t-shirt to arrive.
Yeah, there you go.
I like to say, I mean, I have so many things to say about this, but I realize that this is your show. But I think that the left is being owned. I think if you think back 2 years ago, we were staring at a Hillary Clinton presidency. Judge Kavanaugh was saying, I'm going to be on the appellate court for at least 4, maybe 8 more years before I have a chance at this. And look where we are now. And I think we can thank 2 people for this. Number one, of course, Trump and his backbone to withstand this onslaught. But 2, John McCain for dying at exactly the right time to unleash Lindsey Graham, to unleash Lindsey Graham and Susan Collins. And these people who were terrified of supporting Trump in light of John McCain's wrath of Trump. So I think that all this boils down to just a perfect series of events. And I'm going to add a proud gender traitor to my Twitter name, I think, because that's what I am.
There you go. Thanks for the call. I would say a man who deserves a lot of credit for this
is Lindsey Graham.
Well, go up a step. It's the man you heard from at the outset of this segment, Mitch McConnell.
Yep.
Senate leadership matters. Leadership matters generally. You can have all the backbenchers you want. It's never going to be uniform, particularly in the Republican Party, where you have more independent thought and independent actors. Mitch McConnell's leadership is what drove this. Make no mistake about it. So criticize Cocaine Mitch and the China people all you want.
He's China family.
Mitch McConnell deserves a lot of credit for shepherding the Kavanaugh confirmation through the United States Senate. There's just no two ways about it.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're looking for somebody to respond to Alexis Grinnell's quote-unquote stupid uterus. That's how she describes it in her New York Times op-ed, criticizing white women who supported Brett Kavanaugh. So the left is doubling down on everything you've seen for the last 2 weeks. So ladies, you particularly you ladies in the wealthier, more educated suburbs. You sure that's where you want to cast your lot? Tara in Elgin, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I just wanted to say, first of all, that I am not more resolved to vote. I was going to vote no matter what. I was just probably quieter about it now when I see the Lindsey Graham walking on Facebook to the Saturday Night Live theme, where before I wouldn't have shared that. Now I'm like, eat this, liberal.
Okay.
So that's probably the difference. But I don't vote with my uterus. I'm pretty offended that the identity politics has pared me down to just that. It's pretty demeaning.
Yeah.
I vote a little bit north of center. So,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, thanks for being a three-dimensional human being. We appreciate it. If only there were more.
I mean, what is that supposed to mean? So, since we have uteruses, we're only supposed to vote for women. We're only supposed to vote for Democrats, flaming liberals.
Yes. Basically.
And that I'm stupid because I don't have a pee hat.
That about sums it. You know, here's the other thing. It's funny, as the left cannibalizes itself and minimizes itself.
Trust me, they are doing that.
Do you think there's any chance that a man, I mean a cisgendered man, could be the Democrat nominee in 2020 in this environment?
Oh, the days of the Democratic white males is done.
Yeah, any
That's
man.
That's not.
Anyway, even I mean, you know, to the extent that there are actual men that are still left in the Democrat Party.
Well, Tim Kaine.
Yeah. Yeah, that is.
That went
I mean,
well.
Honestly. That,
I mean, that's it. Like, I couldn't think of any white male Democrats.
Tim Kaine is the most masculine Democrat the Democrats have to offer. There's a statement.
Well, I like the used minivan and the mom jeans that he wears.
Too. Yeah.
The mom khaki.
Sure. I mean, you don't mind. He's on the down low. Okay. Not a problem.
And then everybody else is old, like Bernie Sanders, what, 95?
He's up there. He's, you know, approaching 80.
Yeah.
You know, somebody else that is flirting with a run, as he does every 2 years.
Is it Bloomberg?
It is Michael Bloomberg.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
That silly little rascal.
Yeah, and there's a good piece in The Atlantic about Michael Bloomberg. He's also, I think he's like 76, 78. Another spring chicken.
And he's contributed a lot of money to local races. The woman running against Randy Holgren.
He's put $80 million into congressional races this year.
Oh, yeah.
So that's been a real difference maker for Democrats. Yeah. There's a good Atlantic piece on Bloomberg because it is indicative of the new scrutiny everybody's going to be under. And Michael Bloomberg has a history of sort of offhanded comments. There's been sexual harassment suits. Against you know, Bloomberg employees and so forth, so that, you know, kind of corporate culture issues. He sort of kind of defended. He certainly didn't throw Charlie Rose under the bus. Sort of, you know, let the system decide, kind of Pontius Pilate.
Their internal investigation will come up with.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. So the likes of a Michael Bloomberg, other than his checkbook, the Democrat Socialists aren't so interested in a Michael Bloomberg. It's really, really interesting how the landscape is changing and how small the Democrats' piece of turf is getting. Remember, at present, they are the super minority party in this country. Super minority. That's a fact. State level as well as federally.
It's just that they're huge in Illinois.
Exactly. You get outside this bubble, there's
a
country around us. Lynn in Glenview, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. What are the chances that lady that's voting with her uterus is voting for one Republican woman?
Slim and none and slim left town. Thanks for the call.
There's always Elizabeth Warren. Oof. Just got to get off that paint smock.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Don't miss David Clark and James O'Keefe at Freedom Summit 2018. Get your tickets today at freedomsummitchicago.com.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So President Trump continues rally around the country in Topeka, Kansas on Saturday night.
Oh, yeah.
Been to
Minnesota.
Minnesota, Mississippi, Tennessee.
Where's he going?
Missouri. I mean, he's been everywhere. I'm sure he'll be everywhere again in the battleground states in the next 30 days. But obviously part of his message to the faithful is the robust economy. Lowest unemployment in half a century. We're seeing some decent wage growth finally. a little bit higher participation rate per the numbers that were released Friday. And so what's the downside? Well, for that, we go to Debbie Downer, Jim Pethakoukas, our friend who is the CNBC contributor and columnist for the American Enterprise Institute. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate
and
it.
He won Jeopardy, right?
Jeopardy champion, too, yeah.
Yes. Minor detail. Yes. Just throw
indeed,
that in.
Indeed, indeed, I did. I am also not a Debbie Downer. I am an optimist. I am also a realist, but I think at my core, I believe I am a very optimistic person.
All right. Well, then I want you to explain this piece that I read of yours at the AEI website, talking doing a little historical comparison about how the economy got a little weird in your verbiage 50 years ago when we had unemployment numbers in this range.
Right. Well, yeah, the last time unemployment was this low was the late 60s, which was really the beginning of a period of a lot of economic volatility in the economy. As many people remember, inflation got out of control. It was super high. It was 14-15% after we had that really low unemployment in the 70s, starting actually right after we hit that unemployment peak. We had, you know, four recessions over the next 12 years, two of which were really terrible. And I think the lesson we draw is not, oh, no, things are going to get terrible. It's let's not do the dumb things they did back then.
Exactly.
A big one of which is let inflation get out of control by having the Federal Reserve not pay attention to it. The current Federal Reserve is very concerned about inflation. I don't think that would happen. But when the president says things, you know, he's worried about the Fed. He thinks they're too tight. He likes low interest rates. That's exactly the kind of same mentality that got us in trouble in the 1970s. Hopefully we won't repeat it.
Well, in the 70s, too, we'd get long gas lines. I remember being in long lines to get food. It was a scary time. I know
how,
Dan doesn't remember.
How old are you?
No, I remember during Jimmy Carter. And our mortgage, I'll never forget, we had a 30-year fixed mortgage rate. It was 18%.
Well, yeah,
it was insane. That's why people are buying houses with cash.
But it was the underlying fiscal policy that, I mean, monetary policy. But, you know, wage and price controls under Nixon. Bad idea.
Yeah, we did a lot of dumb stuff. Right.
So, I mean, so there's the fiscal policy choices, James, to address. But then there's the monetary policy, and you were sort of getting to it. And I want you to assess the job because we're sort of in uncharted territory after 10 years of quantitative easing or easy money, where the Fed is trying to unwind from the last decade of monetary policy. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, and so far, you have to think it's done a pretty good job. The unemployment rate is really low, and one reason it's really low is that we've had a very long, if not spectacularly, you know, fast, slow and steady expansion. And as that goes on, it's sort of ground down the unemployment rate lower and lower now that it's, you know, at decades low. And if this keeps going, you know, by the time 2019, 2020 rolls around, the unemployment rate could be 3%, which is as low as it's been since the 1950s. So, you know, slow and steady, fingers crossed, so far so good.
All right. You wrote an article recently about the Trump's new trade deal with Canada and Mexico. What did we get right? What did we get wrong with that?
Well, I don't think this is a deal which is going to have a huge impact. To the extent it has impact, maybe slightly worse. But listen, we're a very big economy. We have a much bigger economy than Mexico and it's in Canada. So it's sort of really tough to screw up these trade deals from the American point of view. And, you know, when the markets went up after the deal was signed, it was really because we, you know, there was a lot of relief that we weren't just going to abandon this trade deal. So new NAFTA is pretty much the same as old NAFTA. The old NAFTA was a perfectly fine, lovely trade deal for the United States. So basically, that deal is still in place. I know the president acts like there's been some massive change. There really hasn't. And now on to China.
Yeah, and on to China. Is it your sense that the president's real play with trade policy at sort of the 30,000-foot level, it's to break China, right?
I don't know. The president, there's not a single message coming from the White House. The president, when he gets on one of sort of his spiels about China, it's really classic Trump where he's worried about they're taking advantage of it. There's a big trade deficit. Boy, they need to buy more stuff. That is a completely different theory from the you know, rising China. They're going to become the leaders in technology. It's a completely different argument, and I hear both from the White House. The president seems to like the former better than the latter. So I am not entirely sure what the goal is. And that when the president talks about, oh, we're going to get a deal, that makes me think it's more about them buying more sorghum than us changing sort of the broader Chinese economic model.
Well, right. But I mean, sort of inflicting some punishment there for currency manipulation, for intellectual property theft. And,
yeah, but the president doesn't talk much about that stuff. He doesn't talk very rarely to talk about the intellectual property stuff. I mean, what is the point? Is the point like helping us, or it's inflicting damage on China? I mean, those aren't necessarily the same thing. And what's bad for them isn't necessarily good for us. They need to pick a theory about what they're doing, because that will go a great that's the difference between these tariffs being a tactic and we'll sign a deal and then back to normal, or these tariffs are going to be there for like the next 10 years, and it's going to totally change the economic relation between these two countries and how China does business. Well, again, it's not clear what they're choosing.
Well, right, but it is clear that it seems to me that President Trump wants to sort of put some distance between the United States and China as global economic powerhouses. And I know there is some distance now, but for the last 20 years of the rise of China, he wants it seems to me be the president that puts China in its place, and maybe with his talk, intermittent as it is, with respect to China, it is to present China with an understanding that if they have to play ball, if they want some face-saving option, because they'll destroy their economy before he can destroy ours.
Right. That is a theory. When the president says we're going to get a deal, that makes me think that's not necessarily the theory. If the goal is them to buy more stuff and lower the deficit between our two countries, then we'll be done with this in 3 months, and it's going to be business as usual. China's economy is not going to be destroyed or fundamentally changed by lowering a tariff here, buying more natural gas products from the U.S. That could be the case, but it's just unclear, and that's a little concerning.
And where do you think Kudlow figures into this mix, since he's sort of the one philosophical free trader in the group?
I don't know. I mean, he's one voice of several. The president also has this economic advisor, Peter Navarro, mm-hmm. who's famous for his book, Death by China. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have to explain what the book's about.
Right.
It's Death by China. In all aspects of selling us dangerous products or killing our economy. And I think the president is more sort of philosophically in tune to what Peter Navarro says. Larry would like to think this is all just tactics on the way to a free trade nirvana of no subsidies, no tariffs, no government. I don't think that's where we're going. That does not seem to be at all with what President Trump has talked about. I hope that idea of Larry's begins to bloom in the administration. But so far, that does not seem to me to be the direction they're going.
All right. And so here in Chicago, we got that Harold Hill character, Elon Musk, trying to sell us a monorail. So your view on Elon Musk's SEC problems and what that means for the future of driverless cars and car spaceships and tiny homes and underground railroads.
It was a
$20 million
tweet, really.
Yeah.
Tesla is a real company. SpaceX is a real company doing amazing things. Like a lot of, perhaps a lot of our leaders, they should probably tweet less. But, Elon Musk has created real fantastic products and is a pretty important entrepreneur. There's other people working on driverless cars who are probably ahead of Elon Musk, such as Google. I like entrepreneurs. He's a colorful character. But he's actually accomplishing real stuff.
I like entrepreneurs that are not welfare queens. $6.5 billion in federal subsidies.
Well,
do you have a position in his flamethrower company or something?
You know, the Nobel Prize that was given out to two people. One, Paul Romer, who's done a lot of work on innovation and the importance of ideas to economic growth. The other guy is William Nordhaus, who's done some fantastic work on the economic modeling of climate change. If you think all climate change is a scam and all these scientists and economists are wrong, you're right. Then, the talk about electric cars a little bit differently. If you think there's something there, then you view it differently as well.
All right. He is Jimmy Pethakoukas, CNBC contributor, columnist for the American Enterprise Institute. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right. You betcha.
See you later, Tiger. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, so the left is not chastened at all by Kavanaugh's confirmation. You got Democrats calling for impeachment, petitions circulating. Cory Booker in Iowa saying it's not off the table. And, of course, Saturday Night Live in their cold open lampooning Republicans.
Don, I'm here in the GOP locker room where the mood is nothing short of euphoric.
Woo! We're going to Kavanaugh this tonight! Let's rally till we move!
Thank you, Senator Kennedy.
Quite the display, Dana.
That's right, Don. There are a lot of pacemakers being put to the test tonight. And I see Mitch McConnell here. Mitch,
Mitch,
how are
McConnell
you feeling?
Was so
that was awesome! Woo!
Do you feel like this is a win you can be proud of?
Oh, hell yeah, Dana. Republicans read the mood of the country, and we could tell that people really wanted Kavanaugh. Everyone's pumped, from white men over 60 to white men over 70.
Keep it up. Keep it coming.
Did you see it coming
for 30 more days.
Did you see Lindsey Graham fist pump Corker on the Senate floor? That's I think they got that idea from that moment. I loved it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Republicans are allowed to celebrate victories too, I would suggest. Yeah.
Didn't play that for a while, but the song is back. I think it's topping the charts right now.
Well, there's a renewed enthusiasm that has also redounded to narrowing the gap between Republicans and Democrats at every level. I say again, not only seeing at the federal level, and we'll talk to Sean Duffy from Wisconsin about that in the 8 o'clock hour, but also just even in Illinois. If it's happening in Illinois, but it's happening in most of the rest of the country, state and local races narrowed significantly in the last 30 days and particularly the last 2 weeks because of Democrats exposing themselves as to the unhinged socialists they are, both on the Senate Judiciary Committee and with respect to their rank and file as people see them accosting senators at elevators from the Senate gallery outside the Supreme Court when Ted Cruz and his wife tried to have a meal. And people are just not down with that, in addition to also seeing Brett Kavanaugh treated unfairly, seeing Democrats' willingness to dismiss a presumption that is foundational in a free society, the presumption of innocence. They're just not down with that, and it's helping Republicans at this point, in addition to energizing the base, because the base sees Republicans, starting with the president, actually fighting for something in the face of the mob for a change. And often we see Democrats or Republicans cower in face of that mob. So it's been sort of a watershed moment for the Republican Party, it seems. And so how can we best capitalize on this? And what does the future hold with the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh? For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Grover Norquist, president of the Americans for Tax Reform. Of course, Grover, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, the Democrats have been cheering on mob rule. I mean, none of those senators told the crowd to knock it off when people were swearing in front of Brett Kavanaugh's wife and kids and screaming and trying to disrupt his ability to present. None of the Democrats said, no, let's do this in an open and democratic. No, they let the mob, they encouraged the mob. Some Senate offices allowed the brown shirts that were running through the Senate to work out of their offices. So the D's have not just stood by. They have encouraged this because they've given up on winning the American people over to their positions. They now want to intimidate people to try and get their way. What the Republicans have done, while Democrats have been out, you know, doing that, Republicans have put forward a second tax plan, making it easier for Americans to save for the future, for health care, for retirement, and in addition, make it easier to start a small business, you know, from scratch if you're trying to get going, and to make permanent all the tax cuts that were made 10 years long in the first tax bill.
Well, give us some of the particulars there, particularly because we saw this study out from the Kaiser Foundation last week about how healthcare premiums have skyrocketed in the last decade, of course, post-Obamacare. And obviously, even with some noticeable wage growth now, those spiraling healthcare premiums, health insurance premiums, eat into that additional disposable income.
Well, you're quite right. Obama and the Democrats said that if you passed their government-run healthcare approach, they would bring down your premiums. I think $2,400 was one of the per year was one of the promises. And of course, they went up by about that amount because socialism doesn't work, because the post office is not an improvement on how to organize things with a government monopoly. And we are living still with some of the damage. I mean, there were three people who didn't let us get rid of all the Obamacare taxes, the Obamacare mandates, and all the rules that made your health care much more expensive. One of those was McCain, and the other two were Susan Collins and Murkowski. So it's particularly important that we have enough Republican senators elected that if somebody like Flake, who got screamed at and then sort of changed his mind temporarily, if there are some senators who, and I understand that, you know, how do you put up with that kind of threat to yourself, to your kids, to your family? Some of them, you're going to lose some of them whenever the brown shirts come out and start nominating people. So let's get enough Republicans that can't ever cost America the opportunity to move forward. But specifically, it makes it easier to get all of, and there are lots of different savings programs for education, for healthcare, for retirement. It expands them. It allows you to put more into these, and it makes it easier to move money around. If you saved a bunch of money for retirement, but you want to, you know, go back to school or you want to start a new business, you should be able to make those decisions yourself. Gives you more flexibility with your savings and your family savings. So having led, you know, outlined what that looks like and where they want to go with it, the Republicans have actually gotten the budget for the Pentagon and HHS, Health and Human Services, about 80% of the federal government, the budgets have all been passed. That hasn't happened in 20 years. So with all this talk about how democracy is not working, the federal government, the House and the Senate, with all this partisan wrangling, has actually been getting more done in terms of just Congress's business. What's the budget for the Pentagon? What's the budget for the Department of Energy? And so on. And getting that voted through on a bipartisan basis, have some Democrats in the Senate to pass these things. And from the establishment, crickets. You remember, it was always the Republicans' fault. When they had the presidency, it was their fault when the budget didn't get done and Democrats had Congress. When the Republicans had the Congress and the Democrats had the presidency, it was the Republicans' fault that the budget didn't get done. Well, now that we have, you know, more Republican control in the House and Senate as well as the president, the budgets are getting done. And the press finds that completely boring. It would rather, you know, show you pictures of people on TV screaming at Kavanaugh's children.
Well, do you think that there'll be a second round of tax cuts for working Americans?
What happened, I should have been clear. There will not only be a second round of tax reform and tax cuts, but what President Trump and the Republican leadership in the House and Senate have said is every single year that there is a Republican president in both houses, there will be more tax reform and more tax reduction. Every year. The reason they wanted to put this out now is that this is what they intend to pass next year. But they've also said, look, there are many things in the tax code that still are problematic, that need to be fixed. The taxes are still too high, period. And we're going to be coming back every year, not wait until the problems, until we have 27 problems and try and do them all at once. That was a big deal. We did that in 2017. But in 2018, there was a $30 billion tax cut very early in the year. So there's going to be a tax cut every single year the Republicans are in charge, and further tax reform every single year they're in charge. That's the point of 2.0. 2.0 is a small tax cut, right? But it's a tax cut. It's good reform. And this is what we'll get every single year if Republicans stay in office. And we now have to also do more government reform. We've done a lot of it by undoing. I love the fact that when Obama did executive orders, that was considered cute. He can ignore Congress. Aha. You know, I have a pen. I have a phone. And when Trump undoes an executive order with an executive order, oh, that's tyranny.
Yeah, right. Of course.
That's
yes.
One man acting alone.
The shifting standard, yeah. Right? Well, let me. Yeah. I want to ask you about Kavanaugh's confirmation in the context of economic liberty. Back when the confirmation hearings were somewhat sane, there was discussions of some of his important opinions as it pertained to the regulatory state and other issues that directly impact the size and power of government versus the individual, particularly in economic pursuits. And so how important is his confirmation when it comes to defanging the regulatory state, say, undoing the Chevron doctrine, for example, which defers to federal agencies with respect to rulemaking and other matters under the umbrella of economic liberty?
Huge, huge, huge. And it is interesting to me that the Democrats do not get up and defend 50 years of creeping government driven by a Supreme Court. Instead of standing up and saying that violates the Constitution, you can't do that in the bureaucracy. If you wanted to do something like that, you've got to get a vote in Congress because that's what the Constitution says. They have not defended the fact that many of the left's victories over the last 50, 60 years have been cheating with the Supreme Court going, we see nothing. We don't see anything here. Go ahead. Do it if you want. And not asking the questions about whether something's constitutional. That has begun to end. Remember the Janus case where they said, you know what, you can't set up a government-supported and mandated union, force everybody into it and make them pay either complete dues or most, 90% of dues or something, because people have freedom of association. They have freedom of speech. You can't take people's money by force as a condition of employment and then give it to the Democratic Party. The bulk of the Democratic Party's fundraising comes from stolen money from labor union members who didn't ask to give it to them. If they wanted to write checks to the Democrats, they could. Free country. You can write checks to the Democrats. But the union takes their money in dues, telling them it's for union stuff, spends most of it on politics, more than on negotiating contracts and so on. And what did the court say? The court said, we're not going to do, you can't do that anymore. But there are a series of other obvious steps. For instance, why should I have to join a union at all? Why? How about if I'm not in the union right now, if I don't join the union, the contract I live under is written by the union. Why is that? What am I, a potted plant? How did I cede my
right
to negotiate with an employer to some union that I don't want to be part of? When that goes away, when everybody can decide, and then I'll make my own deal. I'll cut my own deal. I don't want the same deal as everybody else. I have different needs. I'm handicapped. I'm older. I'm younger. I want more money, less benefits. I want more benefits, less money. I want to work Saturdays. I never want to work Saturdays. Whatever it is that's important to you, you organize that. Not some union which thinks everybody has to have the exact same lifestyle and, show up on the same days at the same time. This is nonsense. And that level of freedom is going to flow from a court that is not consciously protecting the Democratic Party's ability to raise money by force. And that's, we had four Democrat-appointed Supreme Court judges who said, it's fine to make people join a union and take their money and tell them you don't care what they think. They have no rights. And their arguments were all, but the unions and the Democrats wouldn't have any power if you didn't let them steal this money. That was their reason for allowing a blatantly unconstitutional thing to continue. Those rationales don't continue in the future. And the modern Democratic Party is going to have to go out and raise money by earning it. They've shifted somewhat from unions to billionaires now. It's now the billionaire party, Bloomberg and Steyer and so on, putting in $100 million chips. So there is one party funded by billionaires. It's called the Democratic Party. So they're shifting from unions, but they're still largely mostly union money and structures.
Yeah, the Janus decision was a game changer, and hopefully more to come in the direction of economic liberty. He is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, obviously the big stories this weekend, the Van Dyke verdict. And we're going to talk to Van Dyke's defense attorney, Dan Herbert, at 7:37.
Yeah, and what their plans are to possibly appeal and when sentencing is and all that.
And a confirmation hearing, or confirmation, I should say, vote on Brett Kavanaugh. But the other big story, Amy's homecoming queen reunion.
Oh!
Was I right about the... The chasm between the homecoming queens of the 2000s and the homecoming queens of the 1970s, your group?
Well, okay, so they stuck, if you were in the 70s, you went on the back of a pickup truck, in one pickup truck, 80s or in another, 90s, 2000s.
Yeah,
and I had to tell you, or have to tell you, I should say, that you were right. The group in the back of the 2000 truck, good looking. More so than us in the 80s truck.
The 80s
More
truck.
More so than us in the 70s truck.
Yeah, the 80s truck wishing that it was a DeLorean driven by Christopher Lloyd, right?
But the oldest queen who was there was Betsy Bouvier Stoughton, and her husband listens to the show all the time. And he even said to me, watch her get in the back of the pickup truck. She had no problem.
Oh,
she was very agile, very flexible, popped up on that thing. We had another one. I'm not going to say her name that... struggled a little, and I struggled a little too. Well, not really. But you know what I did? I positioned myself next to Mark Gunther. Mark Gunther was the
Mark
king.
Mark Gunther, of course.
Gunner.
Yeah.
We call him Gunner.
Yeah, Gunner.
You know Gunner. I positioned
Gunner,
myself
Squee,
next to him.
King Wilco.
Yeah.
Everybody was there.
I positioned myself next to him because he teaches at Hersey. So everybody cheered for him, and then I kind of sucked up some.
Got the residual cheer.
Exactly.
So what about, I saw on Twitter that you and King Wilco sort of renewed your vows, as it were, replayed your little peck on the cheek from 50 years ago.
It was 32 years ago, thank you. And I, by the way, the picture of me that I tweeted out, I was 16 years old, and I was homecoming queen in 1986, not 1987.
Oh.
So I was...
The high school years are a blur.
Yeah,
it was the
you know
heavy
what?
Drinking.
It was. You're talking about how we forget things from 30 plus years ago.
All right. Well,
so, but
I
do have a picture of the ladies from 1900s. From the
1900s.
90s. Excuse me. The ladies from the 90s. I think they're the hottest ones. And I think when I show you the picture, you'll agree.
Okay. Well,
very good looking. Well,
we'll review those in our off hours. But
no, here they are. And that's not bad.
Yeah. It's all lovely. It's, as you know, my position is it's what's on the inside that counts.
Exactly.
So we're done with that. Finally. Oh, my God. Put that to bed.
Well, it was,
And Melania, speaking of models, Melania in Africa.
She was read the kids a book. She's been there. She had a four-day tour. She went to certain different countries. She was in Ghana, she picked up a 8-month-old baby boy. Who loved him some Melania? If you know, he snuggled in there. He's like, "Oh,
All right. So the only reason we talk about Melania is so she reads the book to children, and then you do Melania reading the book to children.
This one's called Elephant and No Tiger, No Lion and the Mouse.
It's nice to be here with you, and I have a book that I will read.
Book.
The Lion and the Mouse. Did you hear about the book that before? Yes.
Is she reading to the Senate Judiciary Committee or to children in Africa?
Children.
Lion sleeps. Mouse runs over his back. Lion wakes up.
Oh, my God. I can see tears streaming from T-Bone Booker's eyes as she's reading that. Now you do it.
Lion and the Mouse. You all have a book. The lion sleeps and the mouse runs over his back. It's not as good as Party Animals.
Party Animals.
Why?
Lucy Goosey was thrilled. She was filled with delight.
All right, now you do it. That's one line.
Lucy Goosey was thrilled. She was thrilled with delight.
All right, that's pretty good.
Thank you.
But
she's back home now, and she's hot, and that's all you can really. And an elephant ran into her. Did you see that? A little baby elephant?
Lions and Tigers and Bears, oh my. Yeah. All right.
Coming up.
I hope she didn't take any conflict ivory back with her.
She also walked off the set of an Indiana Jones movie. Did you see that?
Oh, with her outfit?
With her little outfit. Yeah. Looked like one of the...
It's not little outfit. Please don't be minimizing her importance. It was just a beautiful, stunning outfit.
Like Kathleen Turner Romancing the Stone.
Kind of.
Before Kathleen Turner.
Yeah, well, you know. Yeah.
Well, they took offense because her hunting hat or whatever you call that was white. And she shouldn't have. She should have worn khaki.
Nobody cares.
Colonialism.
Yeah, nobody cares.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, before you read about it on Facebook or Twitter, or hear about it from your friends, find out what today's big stories really mean with me, Sean Hannity, today at 2, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so the surprisingly quick, I thought, verdict in the Jason Van Dyke case on Friday afternoon. Thankfully, the response was peaceful and, frankly, largely celebratory. Dan Herbert was Jason Van Dyke's defense attorney, and he had this to say after the verdict.
We've all heard about the Ferguson effect, and I can only imagine that if police officers think that they can never fire against somebody that is acting the way Laquan McDonald did when they're 12 feet away from them. I think that what we are going to have is police officers are going to become security guards. There will not be a police officer getting out of a car to confront somebody. And maybe that's what everyone wants. I don't know. We'll have to see how it plays out.
And that's what I heard all week long from my police officer friends. Is that they're back into the fetal position. They're not going to risk their not seeing their daughters graduate from high school or walk them down the aisle because of what happened.
Police officers becoming security guards. I got a text from a Chicago police officer friend of mine who said, today is the day that proactive policing died. We'll see. But in terms of the four corners of this case, one thing was clear from the verdict. Particularly how quickly it was reached. One, they thought that the first shot fired was unlawful. So much has been made of the 16 shots, but convicted on 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm means that he should have never fired in the first place, according to the jury. Number two, from the jurors speaking, some of them after the verdict was announced, they didn't believe Jason Van Dyke, so the decision to put him on the stand.
Yeah, they did not like the fact. They said he was too rehearsed. Some didn't believe him. And then there was also the closing arguments. One juror, she was a forewoman, she said that she was upset that Dan Herbert brought race into it.
I don't feel that it did until the end. The statement that was made at the end was wrong to me. The Boy Scout statement. I just didn't feel that was appropriate.
This was Dan Herbert, the defense attorney.
That was really inappropriate. We're past all of that. We didn't come here because of race. We came here for right and wrong. That's all.
Right, and she was referring to essentially saying Laquan McDonald was no Boy Scout.
Right.
Yeah. All right, for more on the trial and the verdict and the implications, we're pleased to be joined by Dan Herbert, defense attorney for Jason Van Dyke. Dan, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Sure. Good morning.
Morning. Let's just start with a big decision for you and the defense team, and that was to put Van Dyke on the trial. From what you heard from jurors after the fact about, frankly, they didn't think Van Dyke cleared the credibility threshold, do you regret that decision?
I don't. It's always a difficult decision whether or not to put your client on. At the end of the day, it's your client's decision. But, had he not testified, we would have been hearing different things from the jurors that he must have been guilty because he didn't testify. So, the only pause that I had about putting him on is that the case was going in so well for us at the evidence standpoint that, I was careful about not wanting to risk everything by having my client take the stand. But at the end of the day, I don't think he moved the needle one way or the other, but the goal was not to go backwards. And I don't think he did.
Yeah. All weekend long, I've just been praying for him and his family. And how's he doing? I know he's in the Cermak Hospital, so he's not in general population. But what's going to happen?
Well, we're going to wait for sentencing. And, we're going to certainly try and get these charges and the verdict dismissed based on a number of factors. But, at the end of the day, the worst he should be looking at is, and it is bad, but it's 6 years in jail, which would be at 50%. So 3 years is really what he's looking at, should be looking at.
Really? I mean, even with the 16 counts in which he was convicted for aggravated assault with a firearm?
Yeah, it would have made no difference whether it was one guilty verdict for one count of the ag bad or 16. It's all a single physical act. And same is true with the second-degree murder conviction. The court cannot sentence on both ag bad and second-degree murder, so there's going to have to be one of them will have to be dropped, and it's likely going to be the second-degree murder.
Were you surprised by the verdict, or do you just come to the realization, perhaps, that the video evidence was just not surmountable?
Well, you're right about the latter part of your statement. We know, as we sit here today, that the video evidence was insurmountable because that was the only evidence that the state presented in support of its case. Everything else, I think we won every single day, the defense going into this. And, obviously the goal is not for us to win these days, but it's to not lose. You hear the burden was backwards. We came into this case, he was convicted of first-degree murder, and we had to present evidence to get the jury off of first-degree murder, and we did that, even though the outcome was not ideal. That's the reality here.
I loved what you said in your closing statements, that if he would have listened and would have dropped his knife, then he'd still be here today. Because that's true. I mean, he how many calls were there to ask him to please drop the knife before shots were fired?
Oh, there was over 50, I know, 50 times where police officers in full uniform with white sirens blaring and told him to drop his knife. He didn't do it. But here, now, there won't be confrontations for individuals like that. It will be the police will wait till he gets tired or just gives up or kills somebody. So, we're not going to have these problems in the future, unfortunately, fortunately, depending how you look at it.
Yeah. The question that sort of bedeviled me if I was a juror, I'd want a pretty compelling answer to. From the video, you see, obviously, officers at the scene, and then Jason Van Dyke and his partner roll up on the scene. And Jason Van Dyke makes the decision to open fire, and no other police officer on the scene did. How do you explain that?
I think Jason Van Dyke was put into a situation that really was a perfect storm against him. He got out of that car, and he fired quickly. But he got out of the car. He was in a bad position. Part of that was his partner kind of put him in that spot. And, to be quite honest, these other police officers did not contain the situation at all. It was continuing to escalate, and the situation was continuing to get out of control.
What do you mean by his partner put him in that position?
Well, when he pulled up and stopped the squad car, you have to get out of the squad car because that's really the most dangerous place to be in if you're going to be attacked by somebody. So when he jumps out, now he's got the squad car behind him, and he's got Laquan McDonald advancing on him. He didn't have anywhere to get any shielding or turn around and run because he was just in that spot right there confronting him.
So physically, the partner should have established a wider perimeter is what you're saying.
Yeah, in hindsight, you can look at a lot of different things, but it's like when you pull up on a bank robbery, you don't want to pull up right in front of the door. You always want to give yourself a little bit of room, and and that wasn't done here, and you know, that certainly factored into Van Dyke's quick decision.
Well, the issue you just said, Laquan McDonald was advancing on him. You know, from the tape, and this was an interesting part of the testimony that Van Dyke offered as well. He thought he was backpedaling in as he was shooting, and clearly the tape shows he wasn't. So that, you know, it just goes to kind of his orientation in that moment and how he remembers what went down. So that was interesting. But, you know, the position is Laquan McDonald was advancing on Van Dyke, and what the videotape seems to indicate is that Laquan McDonald was, you know, angling away from Van Dyke, and this is something that a lot of people hung their hat on as well in terms of saying the shoot was bad.
Yeah, and that's why we did our animation recreation where we showed unrebutted evidence that Laquan McDonald was absolutely advancing on Jason Van Dyke. He got within, he went from 39 feet to, I believe it was 13 feet in a matter of seconds. So the notion that he was moving away from Jason Van Dyke was simply proven false.
Have you spoken with your client this weekend? How's Jason doing and his family?
You know what? I have not spoken with him. I understand his family was at Mass yesterday. I believe some of his friends are there and go see him tomorrow at Towney.
FOP, maybe it was Kevin Graham, but I heard a statement over the weekend from Chicago FOP that there's going to be an appeal to the conviction. Is that your understanding? Is that what you're planning?
Yeah, that is my understanding. I mean, there's really a lot of appealable issues here, and I think certainly this the venue issue is the venue issue in the jury instructions. You know, I listened to a lot of the jurors talk about some of the reasoning for voting, rendering the verdict that they rendered, and a lot of those were contrary to law. You know, one was that, well, he should have used some less lethal options prior to using his firearm, and that's contrary to law. The law says that police officers do not have to use lesser alternatives. We tried to get a jury instruction on that issue, and we denied.
So, well, what do you think it means, too, that they found him not guilty on the police misconduct charge?
I think it's an inconsistent verdict, because that they found him not guilty of violating a law while acting as a police officer, but then they found him guilty for violating laws. So it's inconsistent.
Let me ask you this. You had another decision to make prior to the important decision of whether Van Dyke testifies on his own behalf or not, and that was jury trial or bench trial. Why jury trial, not bench trial? Do you regret that decision?
We do not regret that decision one bit.
Okay.
The decision, it was a difficult decision, but it really wasn't for my client. It was difficult for me as a lawyer, but that's another decision that has to be made by the client. And Jason's mindset all along was, I am in this situation because of politics, and I am not going to allow my fate to be decided based upon the same politics. So for him, it was really never an issue.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand that. In Cook County, I mean, obviously we know where these judicial nominees and these judges come from. And so, you know, the politics of it and consideration by one person in terms of the implications of acquitting him on these charges. So I understand that, and I understand that was a difficult decision. Just kind of generally speaking, you heard the one juror reacting to your mention of Laquan McDonald not being a Boy Scout, and there was much evidence presented at trial that substantiates that claim. But there is, and I hate to Monday morning quarterback you, but I'm sure you're doing it to yourself too. Is there anything that you would have said or done differently in the presentation of the defense for Van Dyke?
Honestly, no, nothing of anything major. I mean, I look at every opening, close, witness that I put on, every trial, I always look and say, should I have done this? Should I have done that? And I think that in every situation, I always come up with a couple of things that I think could have been done differently. But honestly, in this case, I really am proud about how this trial was conducted. And, despite the guilty verdict here, I think anyone that watches a trial that understands the rule of law will say that, we won every single day of that case. And that's what we had to do to get him off this first-degree murder case.
All right. He is Dan Herbert, criminal defense attorney for Jason Van Dyke. Dan, thanks for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Sure. Take care.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We spoke with Dan Herbert, Jason Van Dyke's defense attorney, at the bottom of the 7 o'clock hour. Coming up, we have Joe McMahon, who is the Kane County State's Attorney and the special prosecutor in the case against Van Dyke. He had this to say on Friday after the verdict.
The end of this trial marks an opportunity for this city to come together. This investigation, this criminal prosecution of Jason Van Dyke, I believe reflects our shared values and has been the result of people simply doing the right thing. Today, our justice system fulfilled its obligation of justice for all.
And, of course, the implications, this is an international story, the implications extend beyond this case and beyond this city and state. And that was the point that Laquan McDonald's uncle, Reverend Marvin Bradley, made at Rainbow Push.
We believe that this fight for justice for Laquan represented a fight for families across this country that have tried over and over again to get justice.
It is worth noting, and I know Joe McMahon is going to discount this because his political and philosophical leanings have nothing to do with his job as a prosecutor. However, since we make mention of people's backgrounds in every other context, then I'm going to make mention of it here. And for all of those Chicago liberals celebrating the Van Dyke convictions, the man responsible who led the prosecution is a white male suburban conservative. Oh, the horror. Well, so maybe in part of going back to McMahon's statement, part of, this kind of shared values unifying event going forward can be dispensing with the nonsense and intellectual poison that is identity politics, which is otherwise celebrated in Chicago.
And Laquan McDonald's great uncle, who you just heard from, he was very candid. It was a very long press conference that he had, and he had mentioned, we were nervous at first. You had this white man from Kane County where you all know, and he looked at him and said, you all know what it's like to get pulled over in Kane County as a black man. Praised him for the work that he did.
Yeah.
And thanked him.
So
he said, because others wouldn't believe him, but we believed in this man and he delivered.
So perhaps a teachable moment on multiple levels here. And that's one of the underreported levels, I would suggest. For more on the prosecution and the verdict, we're pleased to be joined by the aforesaid Kane County State's Attorney, special prosecutor in this case. I think a lot of people forgot that. There was a special prosecutor from outside Cook County in this case, and his name is Joe McMahon, who joins us now. Joe, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here, Dan and Amy. Thanks.
Just the process for you and your team being brought in from outside Cook County to try this politically, racially charged case in Cook County. Give us some background on that.
So maybe 2.5 years ago, I think it was probably June of 2016, I received a letter from Judge Gaughan. I think it was a letter that he sent out to a number of other state's attorneys across the state. I don't know for sure, but I know I'm not the only one. Asking if I was willing to accept the appointment of special prosecutor. And I looked at that. I considered it. I talked to colleagues of mine inside and outside the office about whether I should accept the appointment, what that would mean for our workload internally, and, you know, ultimately decided it was the right thing to do. I feel very strongly that the case should have been prosecuted by a public prosecutor, one of the state's attorneys or one of the public prosecutors across the state. And I knew I could put together a team that could do it.
What was What was the biggest challenge you faced?
The workload on this case was immense at times. I mean, the volume of information that was transitioned from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to my office, getting up to speed on that as quickly as possible. And then, you know, the other big challenge, you touched on it just a moment ago, overcoming the public perception of, you know, could I do it? Could we do this case? How would we be received by the community? And this case, because of all of the issues that are, you know, part of the narrative on this case, you know, our work needed to be accepted by the community. And then we needed to be able to deliver on those results in the courtroom.
Most of those reacting who wanted to see Jason Van Dyke convicted are satisfied with the verdict, the conviction for second-degree murder, the 16 counts of aggravated assault with a firearm. Were you satisfied with the verdict? Is that what you anticipated?
I am absolutely satisfied. The jury was incredibly thoughtful, and we certainly watched them during the trial. They were very attentive. To get to second-degree murder, they had to find that we proved first-degree murder beyond a reasonable doubt. And then they worked through the jury instructions and the law on whether or not there's a mitigating factor, and they found that. And, they found him guilty of all 16 aggravated battery counts. A big part of our theory that the first shot and all 16 shots were unnecessary, and their verdict's consistent with that theory. So I am completely satisfied and grateful for the work
that
the jury did.
That to me is an important point because, of course, so much was made in the public arena, media, in debate about this 16 shots. And the key here is the first shot was as unlawful as the 16th, according to the jury. So he should have never discharged his weapon. So it just becomes a matter of the number of times. It's redundant to the first decision they made, which is that he should not have discharged his weapon. That's really a key takeaway from this verdict.
It is. I completely agree. I mean, central to our theme and to our strategy was that he had other options and he should not have shot that first time.
Well, do you have? Sorry for interrupting. Continue.
It's okay.
Do you feel bad for Jason Van Dyke, and do you realize how stressful being a Chicago police officer is?
Absolutely. I know how stressful it is to be a police officer, and they have an incredibly difficult job, and certainly I feel for Jason's family. I learned a little bit hearing about what they're going through during the course of this trial, and there are a lot of tragedies all around on this case, and Mr. Van Dyke's family is part of that tragedy as well. And I feel for them as well. But my focus had to be, and it has been from day one, on the actions of Jason Van Dyke. And one of the other takeaways from this case is that no one is above the law. That the rule of law we talk about, it applies to everyone, and it applies to a police officer. We put high expectations on them, and they have an incredibly dangerous job, but they have to comply with the law as well.
When the decision was made to put Van Dyke on the stand to testify in his own defense, a decision that we just talked to Dan Herbert, his defense attorney, who said, I don't regret doing that. Ultimately, obviously, it's the client's decision, but I don't regret doing that because Jason felt like I don't want this to be decided by politics, meaning just the judge. I want a jury to hear me out. the jury ultimately in post-verdict interviews suggested they didn't believe Van Dyke. They didn't find him credible. Were you surprised that Van Dyke and his counsel made that decision to testify?
We were prepared either way, but in a self-defense case where their theory was that he was acting to protect his life, I'm not second guessing the decision that he and his client made. And he's right. Ultimately, it's a decision that Mr. Van Dyke had to make. So not completely surprised, but as I said, we were ready for his testimony.
Herbert also said that the expectation, as the FOP announced, is that they will appeal this decision. He believes, does Herbert, that there are appealable issues, both the decision by the judge not to accede to a change of venue, as well as the jury instructions per what the defense had requested, what the judge decided, and some of the comments by jurors after the fact. For example, Herbert mentioned one juror saying he should have, used something less lethal than his gun initially, and that runs afoul of the jury instructions. How do you respond to the possibility of an appeal and those as appealable issues?
Well, every criminal conviction results in an appeal, so it doesn't surprise me that they're saying there's going to appeal. There is an appeal in every criminal case. We went through extensive pretrial hearings on the change of venue issue. The judge heard from two experts, one that we brought in who was local and one that they brought in from another state. And then to follow up on that, the judge went through really detailed jury questioning, individual questioning about people's ability to be fair. And if they did know something about the case prior to its start, would they have the ability to set that aside and make a decision based on just what they heard during the trial? And that was made crystal clear during jury selection. So, I recognize that that'll be an appeal. We're prepared for that, and I'm confident in the approach that Judge Gaughan implemented and followed in this case.
What do you expect to happen at the sentencing hearing? How many years do you think he'll get behind bars? Can you predict that or any thoughts?
Yeah, so I'm not going to predict that. We're just starting. We have done some preliminary work on sentencing issues, but I'm going to restrict my comments to what sentencing should be once we're in court at that sentencing hearing. Ultimately, that's a judicial decision. That is, I can make a recommendation, but ultimately that's a decision for Judge Gaughan to make.
Dan Herbert, Van Dyke's defense attorney, suggested he may be facing as few as 6 years in prison. That seems like that sentence would not be received well from the public. Perhaps it wouldn't be received well by you either. Can you give us a sense of order of magnitude? Are we talking about a sentence that's likely counted in decades and not individual years?
What I'm prepared to do is talk about the possibility, and you both and your listeners know what that range is. On second degree murder, under the law, he's eligible for probation, and if he's sentenced to prison, the range is between 4 and 20 years. Mm-hmm. On the aggravated battery counts, the sentencing range, it is a mandatory prison sentence, and that range is between 6 and 30. So we'll confine our arguments to the sentencing range, and again, that's a decision for Judge Gaughan to make.
You heard what I said at the outset, and I sort of anticipated your answer, but I'll ask the question to get your answer anyway, which is, just the nature of sort of what you said in your post-verdict comments that about shared values and the idea that, frankly, your profile, white, suburban, male, Republican can go try a case in Cook County against a white cop, essentially on behalf of a black young man, and people can be satisfied across the range of races and every other identity under the sun that the case was prosecuted fairly, at least those that believe Van Dyke was to be convicted. And the point is, even those who didn't, this the story, at least this specific case, the four corners of this case, becomes much less about race or any other identity in the process, and it's about the facts and the rule of law, as you suggested.
People across this state and across this country expect honesty. They expect its public servants to work hard and to do that work with integrity. And that message resonates across every corner and every community and across the spectrum, the political spectrum of this state. And that's what I knew we would bring. And that's what we did our best to make sure we did in this case.
Dan Herbert said that that verdict will result in Chicago police officers becoming security guards. Is that a concern? Do you have a comment about that comment?
The police officers that I know go to work every day, and they work hard, and they put their lives on the line. They make personal sacrifices. It takes an incredible toll on them immediately or emotionally. And I know they'll continue to do that. They go to work because they believe in protecting the public, and I'm grateful for that. And I believe that police officers will continue to do that across this country.
He is Joe McMahon. He's the Kane County State's Attorney who was the special prosecutor in the Jason Van Dyke case. Joe, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, both of you. Have a great day.
You too. Yep. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, the reactions to Kavanaugh's confirmation over the weekend. Let's start on the Republican side. The man who deserves much of the credit, second to President Trump, is Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. He said this.
We stood up for the presumption of innocence. We refused to be intimidated by the mob of people that were coming after Republican members at their homes, in the halls. This was about treating someone fairly. This was about evidence being relevant, not about unsubstantiated charges. The tactics that have been employed both by Judiciary Committee, Democratic senators, and by the virtual mob that's assaulted all of us in the course of this process has turned our base on fire.
There's no question about that. And you see from the numbers over the last 2 weeks, the number of races that have substantially changed because of the attrition of Democrats at the hands of their base in terms of the hysterics that McConnell was referring to, the mob at the elevators outside the Supreme Court doors and all of that, as well as the histrionics of the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee on public display. 20 million people saw the Democrats for who they are, and they didn't much care for it.
And the female senator who made it all happen spoke, Susan Collins, why she did what she did.
In this country, we have a presumption of innocence. And as a matter of fairness, what I decided to use as a standard was the question of, is it more likely than not that Brett Kavanaugh assaulted Christine Ford? And there was no corroborating evidence that he did so. Each of the people that Professor Ford said was present that night have testified under oath, both to the committee through the declarations that they submitted and to the FBI now, that they have no memory of this happening. And that includes Dr. Ford's best friend.
Right. And so what you have is, on the one hand, you had family, friends, professional colleagues through the decades rally around and vouch for Brett Kavanaugh. And around Ford, and this was pointed out by somebody on Twitter, I thought this was a good summation. Around Ford, you had Hollywood celebrities, you had Senate Dems, you had political operatives. no family, no friends, no corroborating witnesses, and even those that wanted to be supportive couldn't corroborate, could, you know, be supportive as a friend, couldn't corroborate her story as a matter of fact. So Susan Collins steps up and Kavanaugh gets confirmed. And while that process was going on, the left continued to double down.
Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down!
Banging on the doors of the Supreme Court.
Did you see that one woman who was literally, I mean, she, you know, you can break a bone if you hit something that hard.
Protesting is a full contact sport for the left. Mike Pence presiding over the actual confirmation vote and needing a full phalanx of sergeants at arms.
Sergeant at arms will restore order in the gallery.
I believe that was Mazie Hirono. Not sure. But interrupted multiple times for the confirmation vote. And just the reactions pouring in from the left. A writer for The Colbert Show. Mm-hmm. Whatever happens, I'm just glad we ruined Brett Kavanaugh's life.
Well, that's nice.
Very interested in the truth, obviously.
Yeah.
CNN getting perspectives from a number of women. Roxanne Jones, a founding editor of ESPN Magazine. Kavanaugh's angry and defiant attitude of entitlement is no different from the marauding men who invaded America centuries ago with the goal to create a world in their image. Alexis Grinnell, in the New York Times. The people who scare me the most are the mothers, sisters, and wives of those young men because my stupid uterus still holds out some insane hope of solidarity. My Stupid Uterus, you remember, was my cover band. It was a Vanity 6 cover band in the 80s. So the talk of impeachment, more than a dozen Democrats still talking about impeachment of Kavanaugh, you know, in addition to Trump, were they to gain control of the House and Senate. Cory Booker not taking impeachment off the table out there in Iowa, prospecting for votes come 2020. Petition circulating. So the Democrats appear intent on doing their part to keep Kavanaugh a central issue through November 6th. The question is, how will that impact Republicans? For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Sean Duffy, Wisconsin representative from the 7th Congressional District. Sean, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's great to be with you guys this morning. Thanks for having me on.
And so, the sense and the numbers that inform the sense is that the last 2 weeks of Democrat conduct has been a great boon to Republicans. Where do you see races both within your caucus and within your state?
Yeah, so it's important to note that the Democrats were far more energized than Republicans going into this election. They're angry at President Trump. And the whole Kavanaugh debacle from what progressives were doing to Judge Kavanaugh have energized actually Republicans now. And the energy on both sides of the aisle is about equal. So I do think this is far better for statewide races. So our Senate races, I think this is a much better phenomenon. I still think we have a slugfest going on in the House. And you hear Democrats saying and political
prognosticators,
crystal ball readers.
Yeah, right.
Yes, thank you. I'm just having my first
Monday.
Cup of coffee.
Yeah, it's okay.
It's Monday.
Words are hard.
They're saying a blue wave might be on the horizon. I don't think that's the case. I think we're going to keep the House by 5 to 7. Seats, or if we lose it by no more than 10. It's going to be close, and that's why every vote matters.
And how did the Kavanaugh hearings, you think, it's going to affect voter turnout in what, less than 30 days now?
Well, I think that, again, Republicans are going to come back out and vote. You know, I listening to you guys recap what happened over the weekend, it's nice to hear it all together. I was a former prosecutor. I handled a lot of these cases for 10 years, the child sexual assaults and rape cases with women. And all of us stand up for the horrific, stand up for women who are, you know, horrifically abused by men in sexual assaults. We all do. But we also look at evidence and you say, listen, just because a claim comes in, you got to look at the evidence that surrounds the claim. And when it can't be verified, when Dr. Ford said there's four people that can verify my claim and none of them, even a friend of hers, don't verify the claim. is that sufficient enough to take out a Supreme Court justice? I mean, and there's a sense of fairness that comes into play, and I think that's what was playing out over the last three weeks. And not only that, when you see the protesters, you played all the footage or did the footage of the protesters. We saw that very same thing in Wisconsin in 2011 with
Akron. Yeah, right.
We saw that same kind of takeover of our Capitol with the same kind of chants, the same drum beating, and the same shrill voices. And moderate, independent Americans don't like that. They don't want, you know, those people governing the country. And I think instead of bringing more people to the Democrat side, the protesters actually push independents away from the Democrat Party into the Republican category when they go to the ballot box.
Speaking of Wisconsin, just go off on a tangent here because you have important races up there, Governor Walker's reelection, as well as the possibility of a pickup, Leah Vukmir against Tammy Baldwin. And where do you have those races now? They both seem fairly tight.
Yeah, so I think Walker has a really hard race on his hands. If you look at polling, it shows him down about 4 points. I've seen internal data. You know, I think, you know, frankly, he's up, you know, a point or two based on turnout models. But he has a hard road ahead of him. But I think he actually wins. Leah Vukmir is a little further behind Tammy Baldwin. However, she hasn't had the money to get her message out. She had a tough primary, and it's a late primary in Wisconsin. So right. as she started to have more money come into her coffers, she's been able to get her message out, and I think she's going to close the gap, and we're going to see a close race there too. Tammy Baldwin, if she wins, will win by maybe 2 points. But I think Leah Vukmir, frankly, can squeak out a victory by 1 point up in Wisconsin. And here, you know, we're considered a blue state, but we've been trending more to the right because of the successes we've had. I mean, what we've done in Wisconsin, you now see Donald Trump doing on the federal side, where we reduced regulation, we lowered taxes, and we saw great economic growth. We saw us balancing our budget, which frankly, that's not happening in the federal government, but we did balance our budget in Wisconsin. And the same thing's happening federally. And that's why I think you've seen the transition to more conservative Republican leadership in our state.
Well, it's also attitudinal, isn't it? You sort of mentioned it. The siege on Madison, the state capitol in 2011, and Walker and legislative Republicans held their ground, passed the budget repair bill, and all the doom and gloom predictions of the left did not come true. And the predictions of turning around Wisconsin did come true. And people look at evidence, going back to, you know, actually being concerned about not just a charge or a position, but actually evidence that supports it or doesn't support it. And that's, it seems to me, what Trump and Republicans did in this instance. And frankly, I think there's a lot of Republicans out on the hustings that haven't seen that kind of fight and unyielding position from Republicans for quite some time, and they're rather encouraged by it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. So oftentimes Republicans who don't have culture, who don't have liberal media, we get attacked all the time. And often when we're attacked, we cower and we back down. What we've seen over the last 3 years is actually Donald Trump, for whatever you think of all the tweets or all the, you know, all the comments that he makes, he's a fighter and he pushes back. And when he's pushed back, when he's fought back, he's actually won. And I think that's what you saw in the Senate. You saw, you know, even with this hurricane of commentary coming from the left and from Hollywood, as you mentioned, you saw Republican senators take a note out of Donald Trump's book to say, you know what, we are going to fight back. And I think we can win this one because we're right on the facts. And I think that's been a unique phenomenon that's taken place with Donald Trump. And, from a lot of parts of Illinois and a lot of parts of Wisconsin, they look at Hollywood and how out of touch they are. And frankly, they vote for change. They vote for conservative principles and values. And they're sick over the course of a couple decades that Republicans haven't delivered on their promises. And I love when Trump goes to his rallies, you know, when he puts up the promises made and promises kept. It's really the first time that we've had a president who said, this is what I'm going to do. I mean, whether you even want to go to, you know, moving the capital of Israel to Jerusalem. I mean, a promise that's been made for, you know, for the last four presidents. None of them do it. Donald Trump has kept all of his promises. He put out his list of Supreme Court justices. I think there's 23 or 24 on the list. He's picked from that list. He said, I'm going to reduce regulation. I'm going to lower taxes. I'm going to rebuild our military. I'm going to secure our border. I'm going to bring this American energy independence. I'm going to build the Keystone Pipeline. All these things he's promised, he's actually done. And I think Republicans and conservatives love him for that, even though we might not always love the communication style. We find ourselves in the Midwest a little more kind in the way we communicate with each other than maybe this New York model. But the results, man, it's fantastic for business and American families.
All right. He is Sean Duffy, congressman from Wisconsin's 7th Congressional. Sean, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be with you guys. Have a good morning.
Yeah, maybe he can try out for the kicker position. Mason Crosby, did you watch that game? He missed 5 field goal attempts. 5. I'm sure he's going to be out of a job today. He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Dan and Amy and President Trump not only got his Supreme Court nominee confirmed, he picked up a UFC belt over the weekend. Well, sort of by extension, UFC like 45,612 over the weekend. The featured attraction was that Conor McGregor fight.
Yeah, that didn't end well. They took the fight in the ring to the fight in the crowd when his opponent jumped out. And
the Russian.
Yeah.
Didn't end well for Conor McGregor, that's for sure. Yeah. But in the heavyweight division, you had this guy, Derek Lewis, stage a late-round knockout.
Yeah.
And interviewed by Joe Rogan, post-fight interview. That's always interesting. It started like this with some frankness.
I'm here with the winner, Derek Lewis. Derek, why'd you take your pants off?
Wow. My balls was hot.
Yeah. Your balls get hot, you take your pants off.
Well, is that a problem? I don't know, because I don't have a pair.
I hope
sometimes
it,
I do.
I hope it doesn't become a cultural phenomenon where guys are doing that with
well,
that
did he
excuse.
Literally? I didn't watch it. Did he literally take, I mean, he had boxers or.
Yeah, but he took his pants off, and a guy before Rogan put the microphone in front of him and said, hey, put your pants back on. And then Joe asked, well, why'd you take your pants off? My balls were hot. Okay. Simple question,
an answer.
Simple answer. And then he also, though, disclosed something that was a bit surprising, that an important phone call he got that motivated him pre-fight.
And you were looking for that big haymaker all night. You found it in the last minute of the fight.
I forgot. A few hours before the fight, Donald Trump called me and told me I got knocked this Russian out because they're making him look bad on the news. You know, him and Putin. They're talking about USA and his whole.
Yeah. So take that, Putin. Trump called him and
wow.
said,
wow. He really did?
Knock this Russian mofo out, and that's what he did. Simple as that.
That's not fake news, right? He really called him.
Well,
sure
I don't. That's what he said. I don't know. Who knows?
Because if he didn't, Trump would have tweeted that. No, that's. I didn't call him, but no, I think Trump did. President Trump did call him, yeah.
I'll tell you, you know. I'm not there yet, but I'm almost getting tired of winning.
Yeah, you know what? You're getting tired of winning, are you?
No. But it's been a celebratory atmosphere, some genuine celebration, some parroting the celebration as Saturday Night Live did over the weekend.
Don, I'm here in the GOP locker room where the mood is nothing short of euphoric.
Woo! We're going to Kavanaugh this tonight! Let's Ralph till we move!
Thank you, Senator Kennedy.
Quite the display, Dana.
That's right, John. There are a lot of pacemakers being put to the test tonight. And I see Mitch McConnell here. Mitch, how are you feeling?
That was awesome. Woo!
Do you feel like this is a win you can be proud of?
Oh, hell yeah, Dana. Republicans read the mood of the country, and we could tell the people really wanted Kavanaugh. Everyone's pumped, from white men over 60 to white men over 70.
All right.
And he had a sweat towel around his neck. And it was, whoever played Mitch McConnell was great.
Just
they impersonated him perfectly.
Just keep laughing it up, cultural left. Just keep laughing it up another 30 days.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.